guys care to hear my framework for the Vallis Cube?
Yeah.
You do? Okay. All right. Because I don't want to. No. So what happened was the last time we talked a little bit with John, David was there too, on episode 86. Like I was just, I came down in the morning and you had asked if I wanted to appear on the show on short notice. I'm turning into your, like, your Shecky Green or something like that. You know, oh, nobody wants to come on the show. Who should we call? Let's call Mark. Yeah. You know, and I like it. I like it a lot.
Okay,
so
good.
I like taking the seat occasionally on that basis. So that morning I had, you know, I had just gotten out of bed and was just stretching around trying to think of what I was going to talk about because I had no idea. And I got into that whole Rosemary's Babies thing. But while I was thinking about that, I flashed on this concept of the Vallis Cube. And I briefly sketched it over in my discussion there, but it was more of a conversation because it was still really kind of percolating in my mind. I have a technique I use. I never write anything down. So my numbers were actually wrong on that show. I try to do it all in my head. I keep doing that until I get the, until I'm right, obviously. And so I had made a mistake in regards to my numbers there as well. So here's the idea of the Vallis Cube. Now, already coming from the Hebrew mysticism, we have the so-called cube of space, right? And this is basically a way, I think, for Westerners to more easily interpret this, or not Westerners, but rather modern people, to interpret the cube of space in terms of a technological device. Because just, you know, as Arthur C. Clarke said in his third law, you know, it's magic, it's technology, something, 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 right? Same thing. So, by the way, that was a slight misquote of Arthur C. Clarke. See, somebody out there would be laughing if they had any idea what I was talking about. But anyhow, so I'm thinking about this cube. If it's a cube, it's a cube. So it's going to have a certain length on each side. And then whether or not that length is going to be divided up into smaller cubes is necessary because it gives a number of different surfaces. Like if you can imagine a Rubik's Cube, but across any surface, including what would be the interior cube, that which we can't see. Like in a Rubik's Cube, it's like 3x3, but there's actually not a cube there in the middle. But in my design, there would be. It would be solid cubes. And information would move along any one of the surfaces of what would be representative as a cube within a cube. They don't even actually have to be outlined. They just have to be there. So how many cubes are there within this cube? And I started thinking of it in terms of numbers that had a significance to me based upon ideas that I have in particular that are related to Vallis because of my personal experiences. The ideas that there's maybe just a certain number of people in the world and then that there's literally hundreds upon hundreds of copies of that same world existing in the world at this time. So this gives it's not even an illusion of population. I mean, there are 6 billion, 7 billion people on Earth, but there's only a certain number of them, and then the rest are all clones, and we're all clones in that sense of ourselves living our lives out in some other form, some other part of the world. And this is what I call, and also in other time periods simultaneously. And all of those things are fundamentally us. They are all us, and there's only a certain number of us. We live inside this cube going around, and these little turns and spaces allow us for the opportunity to experience life in a wide variety of time zones, and also geographical zones. And and then we then my reason for believing this was because of the concept of the knowledge of a human being and how long or how many people that they can, because I'm really interested in sociology. And so I've done a fair bit of reading on it. And I logged out there for a second. So, and I came across this thing called Dunbar's number. Now, what Dunbar's number is that this guy was an anthropologist and a statistician who observed that primates and human beings rarely ever gather or know or in their lifetime have significant contact with more than 250 people. And 250 was the way upper edge, essentially, of what he thought. This would be like a masterful human being would have 250 people in his life. And then at the lower end, it was sometimes as low as 75. But he thought that the mean would be somewhere about 150, okay? So using the upper number now, and of course, you know, in statistics, they're always overproving their own case, and this is an important part. So I'm thinking, okay, well, if it's overproved, if the supreme master of any group of people was in a group that was less than 250, and it had to be in a cubical shape, what would the size of that cube be? And I settled on 6 times 6 times 6 for obvious reasons, okay? Because it's the number of the man, right?
Sure, sure, sure.
It's literally saying so. It's the number of the man, right? Right. That's how many there are in each cube of your personal contacts. That is humanity to each of us.
Right. Sounds like a Tesseract.
Well, yeah. We're getting there. So that's our Dunbar number right there, is a little 6 by 6 cube. Now, 6 by 6 by 6 makes 216, okay? So you can imagine that within that group, there would be some people who would never navigate the full 216 cubes that were available. Others would navigate closer to all of them, and then we can presume that there would be one or maybe two who were familiar with the entire thing, just based upon a regular kind of, you know, sliding scale. But so 216 people, but the idea of a 6 by 6 cube wasn't satisfying to me for certain reasons having to do with math, though, because that's a very small number in terms of phenomenon. In terms of people, it's a large number, but in terms of phenomenon, a human being can process many, many thousands of phenomenon, even in the course of a day. For instance, your eye actually sees up to 20,000 different things at one time, and the human eye actually limits its own ability so that the person isn't flooded with information from the eye. So 6 by 6 by 6 just isn't big enough in terms of the sensations and qualities of experience that a human being might have in a normal life, or even in a normal day, quite frankly. So I'm trying to think about the larger cube and representative of the concept of the cube itself from the Hebrew mythology. And from the Hebrew mystic mythology, the cube is Mem, right? It's the 13th letter of the alphabet, and it's interesting in that it is, they claim it to be oblong. And what they really mean is it's basically a square. And actually in some fonts, in really modern Hebrew fonts, a Mem is simply a square. Nothing more than that.
That's true.
Just a two-dimensional square. So now we know that if it's Mem, well, Mem is a number as well, and it represents the number 40. I'm not going to deal in finals right now, and there's reasons for that too. But so Mem is 40.
Hold on, I want to point something out really quick.
Okay.
Last time you brought up Dunbar, the first thing that comes to my mind is Stalag 17. Well, you know, the Germans know where Dunbar is. How do they know? You told them, Hoffi. Who did? You know, so Dunbar is submersed in water.
Yes,
during that scene, and they take him out of the water. The Mem literally means water. Just worth pointing out.
That is worth pointing out, because the actor who plays Dunbar in that film is Peter Graves.
That's true. Yeah.
Right, Peter. That's your phallus, your pike, and Graves. He's in the grave.
Yeah, and so, Peter was the one hung upside down, which is where we get the symbol of the upside down cross in Catholicism.
Unbelievable, and also he became the man from GLAAD.
Yep, and so you know, actually, the hanged man is representative of Peter.
Oh, wild! That's
because
incredible.
Of that.
Okay,
that's why.
So, yeah. All right, and because that brings in the number 17, which is going to matter in just a few minutes in my description. So, we're talking about the
Heaven 17.
Yes. Because I think, believe me, like I believe I've actually got something really profound here in terms of a diagram. All right. So here's how it works. So now we're up to the 6 by 6 cube. The problem is that this doesn't, you know, give us enough for human sensation. So I'm trying to imagine now an appropriate cube size. And if it's a cube, and if it is indeed what I call a box of water, you know, in Hebrew, in traditional Hebrew practices, abortion is not illegal. It is allowed up to the 41st day. All right. And what do we say when a child is born? The water is broken, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a box of water. I'm not going to go into the great kind of scatological or the more, you know, profane concept of a box, but you guys get the idea. It's a box of water, right? So this gives us Mem, because we have both the box shape and the fact that the Hebrew word Mem means water, okay? So we have a box of water, and then we have this related to birth and to the number 40 in a really clear way. Well, it can't be 40. It's got to be a bigger number than that. So I'm thinking you know, what is the, what would be a 16 by 16 by 16 cube? And it turns out that that would be 4,096. Okay. Now, numerology, it's one of those things. People don't necessarily take it very, very seriously, but I have my reasons for thinking this, and I hope you guys can at least kind of get a little hint of what I'm after here. So you have these, this, now you have a larger cube, and it's 16 by 16 squared. The reason 16 at being the chessboard is meaningful for a lot of reasons too. For instance, and I'll just throw this out as trivia because we were talking about Stephen King and his relationship with Kubrick. If you guys watch the credit sequence of The Shining, you will notice that there are exactly 16 credits. And the position occupied by Stephen King is the same when you would count it as the position of a king on a chessboard. So if you were setting up your pieces, starting in the normal left to right manner that we do here in the Western world, you know, you do your pawns first and then you do your back row. Well, king pops up right on that row, interestingly enough. And I think that's fascinating. So I think that there's a chess clue hidden in the credits of The Shining. As a matter of fact, I know there is, because there's more to it than that, but I'll get to that some other time. So I'm thinking that 16 by 16 by 16 would be a really strong representative of water. You have, first of all, 4 by, like, you know, through numerological reduction, mem, 40, just like the English letter M, which is 13, they both become 4, right? So, you know, and 16 is therefore 4 by 4. So it just seems to be exploding out of the number 4 in this sense. So I'm thinking, okay, what's 16 by 16? And you get 4,096. Now, this number is interesting because, it's, you know, I wanted it to be, like, I wanted it to be 4,000. And, you know, I'm not great at math in my head.
Right. So well, that would be something because, you know, in every world you go up, another 100. So there's this whole deal there where you keep
that is possible, and I'm just talking about the so-called 3+1 dimension that we live in now, because we don't really acknowledge we live in the fourth dimension, even though we do, because of the existence of our, you know, linear time element. So anyway, so now you've got this I've justified for myself this 16 cubed. And I'm looking at the number, and I'm saying, well, the 4,000, that's your mem right there. So what you're left with is the 96. Well, the 96 gives you, in the most basic Hebrew letters, tsadi and vav, right? Tsadi meaning side. And what I, as I said, what I think this side is it's a toroid. And there's a, you know, I actually have my reasons from just some evidence that I've gathered that's quite interesting. Essentially, the concept would be that the early Adam actually had a vagina on his side. And it is from this, because this
That's actually, I've come across that. As weird as it sounds, that is, in the commentary I look at, they actually have it that she, that Eve, not just, like, she literally was, there's debate on whether or not she was actually attached to his side. Not that they're...
Yes, that's exactly right.
Which actually, when you look at Plato's, what's it? I'm sure you're familiar with this, Mark. Symposium, where he has the two were one. He has his kind of, his own kind of...
Well, actually, you're right, I am familiar with that. And the early Greek philosophers did not believe there was such a thing as a number one. They didn't count one as a number.
Right.
Two was the first number for them.
Totally.
And, of course, you have that whole kind of song, one is the loneliest number, two can be as lonely as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. So, but this is what I think this means, this side, essentially. Because the human body itself is a toroid. As I was thinking, somebody was pointing out quite interestingly, you know, he said, you know, you never really have food inside your human body. You just eat it and it touches the inside of your donut hole, and then it comes out the other end after you've absorbed some nutrients.
Right.
But it's never actually in your body because your body's a toroid. Well, in a larger sense, and the vagina, the womb, is really the more appropriate term. The womb is a toroid as well, and a donut hole of sorts. And this is actually surprising because the way that you know it's actually like a... it's not a cave. It's not something that you go into and then come back out of, but it's something you go into and proceed through your existence, is seen at the birth of a child. Because when a child is born properly and it comes out head first, you have a toroid right there. the child's top of the child's head has a fontanelle, right? There's skin going over it, but there's actually a little cave-in on the skull.
Sure.
So at the moment of birth, essentially, a donut is giving birth to another donut.
Right.
Right, creating now, and these donuts are what I believe are these sides. That's essentially what I believe this is. When once it's separated, it becomes its own toroid. And as a toroid, it turns in space in a fixed position with inside this 16 by 16 framework, either on one of the corners where these things would meet. And these things can, they don't even have to actually have physical properties, right? This could be an electromagnetic vortex of some kind, right?
Right. Well, actually, I want to mention here that, you know, looking at like Back to the Future, when you're looking at the DeLorean, you could argue that it is representative of the chariot from Ezekiel's vision.
Yes,
the Merkabah, which is literally a cube if you turn it the right way, right? You know, because if you turn a cube on its axis, you can you have 6 points with the seven in the center. Joe has made the connection repeatedly in his videos of the Stargate, where you have in the film Stargate, you have Kurt Russell goes through this basically water portal in order to go to this other dimension. There seems to be and you know, even in Ezekiel's vision, when he's moving through the ethers, in a sense he's literally moving through water, being that he's moving through these clouds, right?
Yes.
And so you can also, I was just talking to my teacher about this, you could relate what is being communicated with the levels of his vision to the birthing process, just possibly happening on another level. But I think what's being pointed to is that the same principle that's involved in interdimensional travel, with your body being the chariot, is also the same dynamics, at least, that are going on just in childbirth.
Yes.
So, yeah, just worth...
that's great, because that's basically what I'm saying, and I'm glad you brought up Ezekiel, because a song that my mom used to sing to me when I was a kid, you know, Ezekiel saw a wheel a-turning way in the middle of the air, right?
Right, right, exactly, yeah.
He called it a flying roll, all right?
Sure.
Well, what I think this flying roll is analogous, or analogous, I'm not sure how you say that word, to that rubber disc that moves tape along on an audio reel-to-reel tape deck. And that becomes a side. As a matter of fact, the term sidereal, side reel, like sidereal is how you pronounce it, but it looks like side reel.
You know, that's funny, because if you're looking at a cassette tape, you're literally, the magnetic strip of a cassette tape, they didn't even realize, or maybe they did at some point, but they didn't take advantage of how much you can actually put on. It's the most optimal way to store information is actually just simply on a magnetic strip. And just recently, I forget how many terabytes they actually did, but Microsoft produced a cassette tape that's like an unbelievable amount of terabytes on a single cassette tape. Joe, could you give us a little walkthrough of the relationship of Kurt Russell to Back to the Future, because I mean I'm sure you probably went into it the last time we had you on, but I find it so fascinating with Snake and all of that, and I feel it might be relatable in this context.
Yeah, so the Stargate scene that you guys were kind of talking about and how it related to the cube kind of relates in this way, because when Kurt Russell is standing in front of the Stargate in the film Stargate, it's the same scene as where Marty stands in front of the amplifier at the beginning of Back to the Future, the giant circular portal. And the amplifier that he's standing in front of is also a giant black cube with the circular part of the amp just on the front of it. But then Kurt Russell is also the same character as Marty, in the sense that Kurt Russell lands on the Twin Towers in Escape from New York, and then in Escape from L.A. he lands another plane on the street where Marty takes off in Back to the Future, where the lightning strikes the clock tower. So Kurt Russell first lands on the World Trade Center, then he lands on the same street where Marty actually time travels. So they're connected both through that same Stargate scene, And in that Stargate scene, like I told you this earlier, David, there's the Stanley Kubrick's little reference, the Serum 114, also printed on the amplifier, which I thought was interesting. And you and I had also talked about that as a reference to the black cube from Pin. What's the movie with Hellraiser? What's his name? Pinhead?
Oh, Pinhead, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So I can get into that later if you want me to, but... Yeah, so basically it's just that street that you had mentioned earlier in this recording becoming a 9/11 resonator because of the giant arrow 9 and then the fire making the 11. And then actually there's a wire that runs across the street that's also on fire that kind of makes the backslash for 9/11. But that street where 9/11 appears is where Snake Plissken or Kurt Russell lands his airplane. But then he also lands his airplane on top of the World Trade Center.
Right, so one is Escape from L.A.
Fucking weird.
Yeah. So Escape from L.A. is where he lands. Not only does he land on that street, but he lands in the exact same spot where the DeLorean disappears in the first Back to the Future, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking weird.
Yeah.
But I had mentioned this to you. He's flying like not just a conventional airplane, but what I view to be a representation of an organic flying creature, like a fucking bird or an eagle or a Horus resonating bird, which is what a lot of people have attributed to Kurt Russell because he has the eye patch and the one eye. But so he flies a non-motorized flying vehicle or a glider in both these instances. It's the only time he flies. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I have made the association of the Millennium Falcon to Horus as well. And the fact that when it goes into light speed, you know, it's literally doing the same thing, essentially. It's basically folding space in order to reach its destination, which is essentially what the DeLorean is doing as well. So in that sense, you could take the DeLorean, it's kind of a jump, but that's what we do here. You could take the DeLorean to be, at least symbolically, the same thing as the Millennium Falcon. So it itself is like a glider, ultimately. It also flies. It has bird aspects as well. I mean, you relate it to a flying saucer. I look at the Millennium Falcon as a flying saucer as well.
Mm. Yeah, and relating it back to what Mark was saying as well about the donut giving birth to the donut and, birth as being, you know, a portal where you're moving from one dimension to the next. It's cool that in Back to the Future, Marty's struggle through this interdimensional narrative is really a struggle for him trying to be born where he's, you know, previously interfered with that process. And now he's trying to patch it back up again. So.
Huh. Interesting. I just had a thing show up that I've never had show up on Skype before where it says call ended with Joe, John and Karen Jensen. Yet I'm talking to you and it still seems to be recording. So
I'm still here. You got me?
I got you. I think John left. I think that's what happened.
Oh, maybe, John left.
He's definitely gone from my list as well.
Oh, I didn't get his message saying he was going. It says Skype home unavailable. Well.
Oh, yeah, no, that's right. He left a message saying, all right, guys, got to go. Have a nice afternoon.
Okay, well, I didn't get that. It's weird. There's like an exclamation point and everything, but the call is still recording, so fuck it. I don't know, whatever. Maybe I'll go to current calls and see if that changes things. Okay, yeah, no, everything's fine, I guess. Anyways, I'll probably try and cut that afterwards. Wow. Yeah, mind blown. So I love how you can even, like, in Escape from L.A., you can still see the clock tower as the clock tower with the clock on it, if I'm not mistaken. Like, and I mean, it's Universal Studios, so it makes sense, but it's fascinating that it's, like, it's so overt. It's kind of
profound. Yeah, it's intact as the same scene basically, and I did quite a bit of research just to find out just how many films use that same set, because obviously it would be quite trivial if it was a commonly used scene, but it's really not. And the two major blockbusters that it's featured in are Back to the Future and Escape from LA, so it's really those two films that it comes down to.
And now I pointed out the last time we were hanging out that you know, there's a trick you can do where O and Z are
L and A. Yeah.
Yeah, L and A. If you flip the alphabet backwards and then juxtapose it with itself forwards, if you look at what letters are directly across from each other, O and Z are directly across from L and A.
From LA.
Just like if you do O and Z then and you have one and you lay the alphabet on top of itself forward and forward, then it's one letter over, just like HAL for IBM. And so,
yes.
And then if you look at that, well, you have what are the two major works of Crowley that are related to each other, is Liber Oz and Liber Al, Al being supposed to be L, but if you look at Aleph, you know, even though you'd pronounce it L, it's still an Aleph and a Lamed. So, for Elohim, but it's, I find that really fascinating. There's this relationship that exists between LA and New York. It's like you have the two, you know, sides of the country are definitely resonant on more levels than just that they're two, you know, city centers, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. Yeah, Escape from New York, Escape from LA, there seems to be some kind of occult reference there, possibly, in that sense.
Okay, I kind of lost track of something you were saying that was very interesting, David, just a second ago. When you started talking about the L-A-O-Z overlap and then the N-Y-O-Z, oh, the HAL, right, because of the, okay, yeah, I was thinking about it in terms of the whole 55-88 thing. And because if there's a connection there, like 55 in profile, could, you know, it looks like an 88 where the number is flashing out, you know, mm-hmm. if it's an LED, it's like, it could be an 8. Like, I guess almost any number on a, that's the thing about LED displays, is that almost any, well, every number on them could be expressed as a form of a number 8. But in terms of the HAL IBM thing, you know that the Hebrew letters I, B, and M add up to 56, right? And that the HAL is 32. Is that right?
Yeah. I guess. I don't know.
It's HAL is 36. H is 5, right? A is 1, and L is 30. And then IBM, that's 10 for Yod, 2 for B, so that's 12, and M is 40, giving you 52. So you have 52 for IBM, and then you have 36. And 52 plus 36, IBM plus HAL gives you 88, right?
Oh,
but more, much more.
Oh, wow.
Because the exact number of white keys on a piano is 52, IBM.
Right.
The exact number of black keys is 36,
and then,
HAL.
And then Stanley Kubrick is an anagram for I turn black keys.
Yes, exactly. But what I'm interested in right now is I'm just trying to see, to figure out what the 80, well, I'm just going to do some counting here while you guys chat. I just need to count something.
Okay.
All right.
Oh, boy.
Sorry, guys. Well, okay, let me tell you what I'm curious about, because a piano keyboard, which has 88 keys on all the standard concert pianos, the lowest key is an A, and the key that's called the middle key is middle C, and then the top key is also a C, and that gives you Arthur C. Clarke, right? ACC?
Or Aleister Crowley.
Yes, but I thought the ACC was interesting, right? Because it's an A down low, but Crowley and Clarke, who knows? I mean, those guys have a lot in common, a lot of weird stuff. But the whole IBM plus maybe the black IBM, the so-called black computer, HAL being representing a. But what I'm curious to know is, what are the 55th? What's the 55th key on the piano? I'm just trying to count it out right now.
Oh, I couldn't tell you. I'm not a piano player. I mean, I used to be, but actually, I played piano for 8 years. It's kind of funny, but
yeah.
I haven't played it in years and years. That was when I was young, so. But no, I don't. I couldn't tell you that off the top of my brain.
7, 8, 9.
Google doesn't
30.
Seem to have answers for us.
Okay, I'm just looking at it right now. It's an E natural. Oh, of course. Yeah. See, that has a meaning to me, but that's getting a little bit obscure. But anyhow, yeah. So but this idea of
wait a minute. That could be something because of Wally and Johnny Five.
Oh, yeah, exactly. No,
so,
that's exactly what I was getting.
So E is the fifth letter of the alphabet. If you look at the film Wall-E, and then you look at how similar he is to Johnny Five from Short Circuit.
Of course.
Who actually, doesn't he come to life because of lightning or something? I can't.
That is correct.
It's been so long, and the poster for it always had like this lightning flash hitting Johnny Five. And so you could relate the lightning flash then to the lightning flash of the Tree of Life. and that, you know, you have Crowley has this absolute fucking obsession with Pinocchio, which when you first told me that, I kind of laughed at it a little bit. But no, oh, did I say, what did I say? Crowley?
You said Crowley.
Oh, it's just, that was a Freudian slip. but no. So Kubrick has this obsession with Pinocchio, basically, and that's his fascination with the uncanny, which is where Toy Story comes from, where you have this idea of something that's just an inanimate object that comes to life. And his whole thing with AI was, and then that relates to HAL, is just how fucking, it's creepy on one level, but that's his main focus, is that technology basically being a mirror of ourselves back to ourselves without a soul. So to basically get to the point where we're literally inserting a soul into the object, which is similar to the Gollum idea too, in a way, because you're giving something that's literally has no life. You're giving it an olive. I don't completely remember where I was going with that, but
But that's actually salient in terms of what I was saying earlier about this idea that human consciousness creates a certain destiny, and that destiny would be to imitate the act of creation itself.
Right.
Like, this is just a natural byproduct of being human, right? Is that, and I mean, you know, if you want to study it in an occult terminology, obviously you have to look at creation myths and things like that. And that gets a little bit dicey, because once you start talking about those, everybody just puts you in the whack-a-mole category. But there's some interesting stuff that comes out of that, including this sort of thing. This is maybe a good place to kind of pick up where I was talking about the cube, because numerically speaking, there's a couple of other things that are quite interesting that I uncovered. So remember how you were talking about Heaven 17 before, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things I was able to mention to you guys last time was that 17 is a representative, and this goes to the whole concept of a holographic matrix, right? The word holographic is obviously massively substandard, right? You might be able to call it, say, a holo audio or something like that, right? Maybe. But so what I did was I looked at the different numbers of, oh boy, I didn't write it down. What a twat I, or maybe I did. Hold on. Just let me look for it quickly.
What a twat you are.
Well, no, because 17, I'm sorry, I never write anything down. Like, I'm a total slob. What can I say? But I'm a nice person when I'm alone. Okay, just let me look at my notes here. I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere. Yeah, maybe not. Well, the basic idea is that, like, if you have a 16 by 16 by 16 cube, there would still have to be an outer shell, like an encasing shell that kept that cube intact, right? And it would obviously seem to be an 18 by 18 by 18 cube. You follow me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the thing of it is that it's not actually. It's a 17 by 17 by 17 cube. And it's actually not even a cube. It's just, it's a shifting selection. It's like, you guys know those tile puzzles where there's one little space that's empty?
Yeah, the
right?
Little plastic.
And then you have to move it around and get the picture. This is how the visual part of our reality is created. There's a 17 by, you know, and you guys have talked a little bit about video games and stuff like that too. Like you're familiar with the idea of the ever fading perspective. You know, like if you're on a Mario Island, you can jump in the water and you can just swim out to sea forever. You'll never reach anything and never really go anywhere, right?
Okay.
And this idea that there could be this horizon event, which interestingly enough, and I know there's something a lot of stuff about the number 53, but the horizon's about 53 miles away to the human eye. And that's how far it always appears to be away, but it's in fact just an illusion that is made by tile patterns, all right? And what tile patterns are basically the things that they use to make wallpaper so that it looks like so that it is all these weird patterns, but there's no place where there's a seam that is visible anywhere. And this is the critical element about the so-called Heaven 17 as a limit, right? This is what Kubrick is saying in that scene. Heaven 17 is up there, and what that means is that the ceiling, because that's what, you know, the term heaven in Latin is called celi, and it's a celis, and it's the exact same word for ceiling. In English, that's what we use in the English language for the word ceiling. So you have this idea then of a visual limitation basically. You're looking that up, aren't you? But it's true. You have a visual limitation represented by a pattern that can be no more than, oh, I'll get that. A pattern that can be no more than 17 by 17 in its shape, essentially. So there you have it.
Hmm.
So, and what happened is it's not fixed. The internal cube, the 6 by 6, or the 16 by 16 by 16, is fixed. The appearance of motion happens when this 17 by 17 by 17 tile pattern, which doesn't quite cover the cube, it has empty spaces. It can shift these things off into to create every single visual phenomenon that we perceive to be the seamless limit of the edge of our sight line, basically, even through telescopes, whatever, which are all just an illusion.
Yeah. Anyway, so. Well, that's a problem when people are, if you're looking at the tree of life, it can be a little misleading the way that it's often represented, because you're seeing this kind of like, six around the seven being repeated, mm-hmm. but it's kind of hard to explain, but you're literally supposed to be, every time you're looking at a spherote, you're basically going into that spherote, and then the other spherotes are all in line. They're also spiraling, but it'd actually be more appropriate to represent it as a tesseract. I hope I'm yes. pronouncing that right, because you know there's this idea that you go into the cube to find the other cube to find the other cube, right. and they're actually in recursion. And because within every spherote there's another tree, it works as a fractal where you go into one and then you're into the other and into the other and into the other, and it keeps extending. So actually, like an infinite tesseract would actually be the more appropriate way to represent it than the way that it's often represented. They represent it the way they do just for the convenience sake of kind of, if you're trying to relate to it. But what's interesting is that if you're also saying that it's the body,
it is, yeah.
The way that cells develop is your cells are dividing in order to expand, right? And so that's why there's really never anything new, because the material that they're coming from, they're not the generation that's taking place is as much of the same substance dividing itself as it's like it's just in order for it to stand out in space it splits and then it multiplies. Well,
it doesn't really split though. It just appears to split and then appears to come back together again. The whole thing is kind of I had a word for it.
Krishnamurti used to explain this, that thought works the same way, where basically he didn't relate it to cell growth, but the implication is there. So yes. that there's never any new knowledge.
Right.
That in other words, if someone gives you a piece of information and you're going to interpret that information, you draw upon everything else you already know.
Yes.
Yes. In order to take in the new piece. But the implication there is that if you're learning something, then you're not really learning anything, because you're literally taking what's already there.
That's
in
right.
order you to project the new piece. And
right.
so cell growth works in the same way, that because it's all one substance, right? Like pan, like literally all, you can't take away from the all and you can't add to the all. You're literally like, it's misleading to say split, because there's a distinction, but there's no separation in the material. And
exactly,
so
yes.
what we're emanating from, we're still a part of. We're not broken off from what we're emanating from.
Terminologically.
But so the point, the first, so it's not until you get eight cells that you have a perfect geometry, which is literally the hypercube, right?
Right.
So you have... So you have a cube that gets formed with eight cells, which is a perfect geometry. And
it's
then,
like a metatron.
And then, exactly. And then the pattern repeats itself, and then it repeats itself again every time more cells grow. But really,
right.
it keeps coming back around to this same structure. And so this is the I Ching. This is the whole premise is that you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then the and then 7, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and then 7, and like
right.
Basically a movement's accomplished in six stages, and the seventh brings return. Is the idea.
But, see, now here's what I think though, right? Because is it possible, as suggested by Philip K. Dick, that this is actually a kind of a fake creation, this seven-point cycle, right? And you can see the seven, like for instance, in a normal scale between octaves, there are 12 different tones, but we usually represent these as a seven-note scale. We skip over certain ones, particularly in Western music. And in terms of the concept of what the West is, it is the element that drives things forward, right? You're, you know, go west, young man, chase after the sun, that sort of thing. And what Dick suggested was is that, and, you know, he used this term, he actually called them, he said the Jewish alchemists figured out how to turn time back around on itself, and then this would prevent coming of the Messiah, right? And so you would, this is why you're always, you can never make that leap to eight. As soon as you do, you get pushed, you get pushed back into this so-called cycle that might not be actually real, according to Dick. And the alchemical cycle, of course, is itself built on the number seven, right? The Azoth sequence, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right?
I would say that it's relatively real in the sense that in the sense that it belongs to a certain dimension, and that there's other dimensions that are beyond it. But this is the dimension that we're existing within, that we're perpetuating, that we keep going around the horn. But that beyond it, there's more. But that this is just kind of like a enclosure that we've kind of established and enforced, that we're kind of perpetuating.
Well, is it us? Who is the we that's perpetuating it, right? Like, are we as a civilization? Or is this something that is a manifestation of the concept of individuated consciousness? Like the idea that I am I and you are you and we're not the same thing. And we may have a completely irreconcilable as opposed to a harmonic relationship with each other. Right? I mean, because these things to me get difficult until you see the system. And you're right in the sense that there is no evolution. You know, in the Tarot, this is in Crowley's Tarot. He writes that phrase on top of the art card. I think it's Salve et Coagule, right?
Yeah, the hidden stone, yeah.
Yes. Well, Salve et Coagule actually just means the solution and the coagulation, or the dissolution, because this is the thing that people don't get about the word solution. Solution is like, it's like stirring something in a cup, right? You know, if you put a really good example of this, if you use non-dairy creamer in coffee or tea. I mean, healthy people don't do this, but if you want to see this at work, that's a perfect way to do it, because it floats for a second on top. It sinks like Atlantis into the liquid. And then when you stir it around, you can see the color swirling in a way that you can't with anybody who's mixed paints or other things like that knows this too, or looked at a mud puddle with an oil slick in it. It just goes out as far as it can from itself, and then turns back in on itself over and over and over again. And from Dick's perspective, this was problematic. It was what created the anamnesis and the constant, pointless, dull cycle, and he felt that it separated us from our truly infinite nature. Right. However, and this is the other side of this coin, and this is what I call the hangman's loophole, if there was indeed a valid system created that indeed did loop back around, then essentially what would be happening was that everyone would be being made technically immortal, right? So now you're technically immortal. So even though you're not actually infinite, you are, right?
Right.
And that's what happens with inside this seven repeated system.
You know, which, what you were referring to before, I don't know if I could quote you properly, but there's this, so, okay. In the Zohar, you know, I kept on seeing this thing referenced. I've talked about it a number of times on the show because it fucking blew my mind. The basically 9/11 being predicted in the Zohar, where you have, and I thought it was bullshit when I first came across it, but I was like looking for a reference where I'm like, okay, really? And then, so you have the 25th of Elul on the Hebrew calendar at the millennium, basically would be a time when there would be three structures that would collapse, that would basically bring in, would usher in the Messiah, And the Messiah is a code, by the way. I mean, it's 358.
Right.
It's not just simply a human being that's going to show up and die for your sins or whatever. Yeah, it's a very profound deal that you have to qualify and understand what's being communicated, because they do explain it, but it's rather heady. But basically, you know, and then there were, in the 18th century, there was a rabbi who came along and said that the time in which was taken to that they're referring to in the Hebrew calendar was actually 2 days off. And then if you look at the implication of what that would mean in terms of our calendar in 2001, it equals September 11th, and which is fucking super mind blowing because it's literally.
Oh, sure, sure. Have you ever seen a film called Koyaanisqatsi?
Yes, of course.
I imagine you saw it some years ago.
Yeah, I probably saw it like 5-6 years ago. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, the next time you watch it, and I recommend you do it soon now, the end of the film also predicts 911. There is a cave painting. It's the last image in Koyaanisqatsi, and it's of a Hopi cave painting. And it's two tall buildings and a bright, sunny, it's something else. You got to see it.
Yeah.
Blow your socks off.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't.
David, pulling this information out of the Zohar, I think you said?
Yes.
I mean, is it possible that other people know about this? I mean, have you read or looked into anyone else knowing about this? Because, like,
they
all
do.
The semi-intentional media references that we find, it's perfectly feasible that if this really exists in the Zohar in the capacity that you say it does, that other people, you know about this.
Yeah, yeah, they do.
Or that it's some kind of perpetuating element of code. Right.
So the first place I heard about it was from Leo Zagami in an interview in Project Camelot, and he didn't give a reference. And so I spent fucking hours and hours and hours and hours looking for the actual reference so I could look it up with my teacher. And the place where I finally found it was total propaganda, bullshit interpretation, but he gave the fucking reference. And so I looked it up, and sure enough, three strongholds will collapse, which are literally metal. So you have like the word, there's references in the Bible to mountains that are literally made out of, not steel, but it gives a metal material. And it's like, what are they talking about? Metal mountains. You know what I mean? Like, that doesn't really make sense. So, but how would you describe a building in biblical times when there are no large buildings like that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But basically, there's three strongholds of Rome that will collapse, that will bring in, that will usher in the Messiah, which is literally looked at as a superstar that will rise and basically destroy or nullify the 70 princes who are overseeing the nations. So in Kabbalah, they have this notion that there's kind of like these overseers or overlords who are not of this dimension, who are basically manipulating or influencing the rulers of the different nations in order to create a certain kind of paradigm. It sounds rather trippy, but this is actually what's there. And so when this event happens where these three strongholds collapse, basically it throws off the 70 princes so that a new, the world that is to come can come into being. This is like, it is a prophecy, and there's, that's the only prophecy I know of in the Zohar. The Zohar is not something that has that's loaded with prophecy. And when I first brought this to the attention of my teacher, he didn't believe me that there even was a prophecy in the Zohar. And he's been studying it for years and years and years and years and years. And so sure enough, this is very prophetic. It sounds like it's like out of Isaiah or something. The way that it's written is really trippy, especially because it's looking at the 70 princes as literally stars. And that the stars get like dispersed or shifted in some way because of this megastar that comes and does this thing. But the star is moved to do this thing when this event happens. That is a physical event in Rome. But we might as well be Rome, as far as I'm concerned. I don't see that as a problem, you know, especially at that time to communicate. And people don't have a problem with that generally. I mean, that's how people approach certain parts of Revelations when it's referring to Rome, you know, and Babylon, you know, where we could just as easily be called Babylon, you know, because Babylon is the great city, you know. It's just...
When you were talking about that whole Zohar thing, David.
Yes.
Particularly at the end of there, the 70 stars, right? I'm thinking these 70 star, like, you know, the number 70 is iron, right?
Sure.
Which means well, I.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that star could then be representative of the star at the top of a pyramid. So there would be one for the United States, and there'd be other stars like that, each of them being eyes. That could be
exactly
70 eyes.
Exactly.
But what I'm interested in is when you were talking about how all these stars get scattered, and it reminded me of our discussion earlier of the cover of the Crime of the Century album, right? Are you there?
Yeah, no, I'm processing.
Okay, so that, yeah, it's got all those scattered stars.
Yeah, if you're going to go there.
It has that purse, that being trapped in this celestial prison, right?
Right, which is Superman 2, which is your Ubermensch.
Yes, that's right. It is Superman 2, exactly.
And the monolith, for that matter. You're looking at a monolith floating in space.
It's seen at the very beginning of Superman 1 as well.
Dude, so this is another example of something predicting 9/11 in A Clockwork Orange. It's very direct. You have him standing in front of the 2001 soundtrack. He hits his cane, just like in Eyes Wide Shut, where the guy hits his cane and the women go to their knees in the circle, right? It's the same phenomenon. Or when Ziegler is hitting the billiard ball, and it's kind of suggestive that he's he's doing the same thing. It's like a form of NLP or something to Bill by doing that.
Oh, absolutely. The reason that I brought up the Crime of the Century album cover in terms of the whole 9/11 discussion is because if you look, I don't know if you guys have an image of it right now, but the way that the band's name is written is very interesting, okay? Because first you have the letter S, and at the top tip of the letter S is a bright white light. And then it appears to zig down, it does zig down in the reverse of the lightning path.
Sure. Yeah, I'm following you.
And then if you look at the two letters P in Supertramp, they frame the phrase Crime of the Century written underneath the album or the band name, right?
Right.
Well, if you look at the way that these things are made, each of them has a point at the bottom, right? It's like they're little dynamite things that are lit, the letter P's, and a light point. And then if you follow the shape, it's basically the outer edge and the roof of a tall building.
Interesting. But you know about Breakfast in America with 9/11, right?
As far as I know, I'm the first person that wrote about that.
About the turning it backwards?
Oh no! Tell me about this.
So if you take the cover to Breakfast in America and you do a mirror image of it,
Losing you, David. I can't hear you.
Okay, so if you can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, so if you take the cover of Supertramp's Breakfast in America and you reverse it,
yes,
the M and the P are one. The M is on one tower of the World Trade Center, and then the P is on the other. Okay,
right.
They cut off the bottom of the M. So basically, the way that it's situated is you literally see two ones and a P, which becomes a nine in reverse. It's very it's very overt.
That is hardcore.
Literally, you can see. 9/11 is written, 1-9 is on one building and the 11 is on the other. It's just there. Right. You can just see it. It's very direct. And then there's a glass of orange juice that's being held over the two towers.
Yes.
From Lady Liberty.
Yeah, are framed there. Underneath two towers, you have the letters U and P, right?
When they came out with their greatest hits album, Supertramp, they had the cover of Crime of the Century, which is the prison bars floating in space like a monolith, and then you have the arm of Lady Liberty emerging out of the prison bars holding orange juice.
unbelievable.
And so what?
I'm looking at that reversed image right now. That's incredible. It's a 9/11. Unbelievable. I noticed about this album cover was actually that breakfast is like, it's the charge-up meal, right? It's the meal you eat to charge your battery.
Right.
Because this is the thing, is that I'm obsessed with these technological references, right?
Right. Well, we were eating breakfast
Battery
during,
Park
during
is the
9/11.
Lowest point in Manhattan, and it's right at the top of her head, right?
Right.
So, like, her so-called, you know, crown chakra or whatever is a battery.
Right.
So it's these particular references to very clearly technological types of things that obsess me when I'm looking at this sort of thing, because, you know, orange juice, that's what you have to charge you up, you know?
Right.
In the morning, oh, I'm going to have a glass of orange juice. And of course, there's a lot of acid in orange juice, right? And acid, of course, is used to make batteries. And so she's holding this glass of orange juice on a, you know, what looks like a flying saucer, basically. On top of it is this big battery. So, and if you look at the Boaz, and yet, if you look at this, there's, Crowley talks about this in Magic Theory and Practice. Do either of you guys have a copy of that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, okay, well, all batteries are combinations of 11, right? He makes this clear in the first chapter. So that all orders, for instance, of the Astrum Argentinum or whatever, the Order of the Silver Star, the order designation in degrees adds up to 11, right? So you start out as 0 equals 11, and then you become 1 equals 10, and then 2, all the way until you become 11 equals 0, right? So, and these are called batteries, right? It's like the pole, but it's the plus and minus point on the normal types of batteries that we use from day to day. And so this is what the Boaz and Yoakum thing are. One of them is 6, and the other is 5. And they represent a positive or a negative flow in terms of the direction of the energy, right? So I'm just, you know, throwing this out there. And of course, and then that's what's happening is that on the Supertramp album cover is that America, represented by its business symbol, is being charged up for something, being energized in order to turn a corner, essentially. So that's kind of where I'm at with that.
Well, this is really weird. I went to look up an image of the Supertramp cover to show you guys, which I just put there. And yeah. These people are like, there's an essay, The Great Harlot of Revelation 17.
Absolutely.
There and then go. It's relating it. So you can see, oh, no, okay, I stand reflected, literally. It's the, I had to look at it to see what it was. So it's the U and the P, which makes a lot more sense. So when you put
it
in reverse,
that is ridiculous.
Yeah,
that
totally.
Is unbelievable.
Totally. Well,
listen,
and so, but
oh, see how the breakfast plate is sitting where the battery park would be too, as I pointed out earlier. I'm looking at a better image now.
Totally.
Right. So that's where breakfast is, and it's an egg that her head cracking as well. Right. The point on her headwear.
Right.
Is scrambling those eggs.
So if you look.
So
if you
what I wanted to point out about this too. What was it? Oh, yes, you were talking about the Zohar and the direct reference that appears to exist from antiquity of the event 9/11. Well, there are two buildings in the Bible, too, right? The two big buildings, Apollyon and Abaddon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, Apollyon and Abaddon are two great buildings. And in Revelation, in the book of Revelation, they are brought down. And the verse is chapter 9, verse 11.
So chapter 9 verse 11 is Apollo, yeah, where it talks about the angel of the abyss.
Yeah. But that's actually a building. Right? If you have a Strong's concordance, right? It's a building.
Right. Okay.
Look it up and you'll find out that both Apollyon, the letter A or a 1, and Abaddon, the other letter A, in other words, exactly what Crowley calls his secret organization, the A is A. The Order of the Silver Star, but in Latin that's Astrum Argentinum, right? So you have the two buildings representing ones or the letter A. And Apollyon and Abaddon are not merely represented. The Orientalism of calling the abyss Apollyon, that's an Orientalism, right? If you research Apollyon, you'll find out that it's actually a building. And so is Abaddon. They're both buildings. So I just thought that was kind of interesting to throw into that whole Zohar thing.
Absolutely. So if you look at the back cover of the same album, you'll see a plane that's running into Lady Liberty, who basically has an orange behind her, holding the orange juice. Do you guys see that?
Yeah, dude.
Okay. So if
David, look at am I crazy, but on the front cover, isn't this picture being taken from the inside of an airplane
window?
Yes.
And so, there's that. And then if you look at all the, I don't know if you can't see it in the shot, but everybody who's sitting at the table is looking at different tragedies in the newspaper at different.
God. Yeah, that's right. I remember that from having the album back in different parts
of the world. Okay.
Get out of here.
And then if you look at Crime of the Century, you're literally looking at the monolith, right? Where there's someone's being held in prison inside the monolith, floating in outer space. And so this is the way. So I watched this film with this album over and over and over again. And the point at which because I was looking at song by song, what is relatable to which scene, and this is how it happened to land. And it's that I ordered this. So I ordered this 2 weeks ago. Can you see if it's arrived? A folded piece of paper. Alex does not tell the clerk which album he's looking for or by whom. It's a folded piece of paper, which is almost like it's secret or something. So right. There's something very weird about that. And it happens to be playing Ode to Joy at the moment. And actually, the lyrics to Ode to Joy burst in right after he hands him the paper. Okay, later on in the film, the point at which I'm starting Breakfast in America, which is the same phenomenon where I'm looking at the song, what the songs are and where they need to land and how it actually like worked out, this what blew my mind, because the moment at which Gone Hollywood, which is the first song on Breakfast in America, when the beat drops, when it actually comes in, is at the moment of a demolition project where a building collapses, followed immediately by SS men kicking in a door. Okay.
I cannot wait to see this.
So they're invading people's homes, right? It's like the end of liberty, followed by the destruction of a building, is actually the moment at which it comes in. And so it's too much. You got 2001 right there, hits the cane, hands him the paper. That's the point. So in a sense, you're looking at something that seems to be another example of predicting.
Well, I mean,
this by itself.
This is the reason why I choose to study Kubrick.
Okay? Right. Well, this by itself wouldn't be that profound necessarily if it wasn't for the Millennium Hilton.
Right.
So the Millennium Hilton in front of the two towers, Hilton written in 2001 as Haywood Floyd, who's doing the cover story to cover up what's going on the moon. You know, on the dark side of the moon.
It's also cool that this is actually, Dave, I don't know if you're still talking.
No, it's fine. Yeah, go ahead.
It's also Breakfast in America, as in the morning when 9/11, everyone was having breakfast. But it's also like Wake Up America. Like breakfast is what you eat when you wake up. Like 9/11, wake the fuck up.
Absolutely,
exactly. And then Child of Vision.
So, I guess the ultimate question becomes: is that are we looking at some kind of phenomenon that is an aspect of code? Or is there an actual group of, shall we say, entities, individuals? When I say entities, I don't mean like spiritual. I mean corporations, whatever, right? Secret societies that carry these things out and put these things in our popular culture to the point where we have a code base in our head by the time we actually see the event. Like, I don't know. What do you guys think about this?
I don't fucking know. I just know that it's a phenomenon that I can't necessarily explain.
Mm. Well, that's fair enough. That puts her simply.
Yeah, no, but so my Occam's razor when it comes to the Zohar referencing 9/11, that it happened, because I mean, European occultists would not be ascribing to the earlier text. They always do this thing, and I've seen it consistently, where they take the most recent thing. So now that in the 18th century there was a rabbi who changed the date to be 2 days earlier, which is fascinating of itself. It's like, I thought it was off. I'm like, oh, it's off by 2 days. And then I find out that no, it was actually
right, yes.
It was actually adjusted. Which one would they ascribe to? They always ascribe to the most recent, because that's just what they do. I've seen it over and over again. They don't look for the earlier attributions. They look for the most recent. And so for the fact that date that's given for the destruction of the buildings in the Zohar is actually translates in 2001 to September 11th. I just find that pretty unbelievable.
I just want to add one thing to this discussion. I don't know about you guys, but is that waitress hot or what?
Dude, she's gorgeous.
I want kippers for breakfast, mommy.
They can have them in Texas, you know. So yeah, I don't know. And so the fact that it starts out with Gone Hollywood right as he's got his lid locks on again, you know, he's being forced to watch these films. He's like, oh, like going to the cinema, you know.
Actually, you know what, David? You've nailed something for me here because the song Gone Hollywood, I mean, it seems like an odd song to be the opening track on an album that features New York City on its cover, right? I mean, is this person leaving from the plane or are they arriving in New York? Apparently, they're leaving, right? They are leaving New York. And this is one of the things that I noticed in Eyes Wide Shut when Dr. Bill goes to Rainbow Fashions the first time and he asks for the original owner, a man named Peter Grenning, right? But
Right.
Peter Grenning's moved on to Chicago. So the green penis, the vitality isn't in New York anymore. It's moved on. Well, Woody Allen just did the same thing. This is what I wish to tell you. In his movie Blue Jasmine, that film is also about the collapse of New York as a concept and this idea moving westward. So I just thought I'd throw that in there as well. It seems to be coming out of it all over the place. You know, I'm a little bit shocked right now. I can't wait to do this.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to buy both albums. To
it's
do it
fun. Now. And if you think about the thing with Superman, you know, Patrick realized that the notes in the Superman theme song with Christopher Reeves are actually it's a play overtly on Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Without a question. Yeah, they're the same fucking notes in the same
exact
order.
Same notes. Yes, yes, yes. John Williams is a clever little bugger.
Yes.
And yeah, he's definitely, I mean, the idea of the Superman also sprack the Zarathustra. And then, of course, what he's really doing is he's reversing time. So we keep coming back to this thing about reversing time over and over and over again. But what I wonder is, and you know, that's on, doesn't, maybe the reason that we are perceiving what we're perceiving now is because time is actually moving backwards. And we're still processing it as a forward event, but it's actually taking place backwards. Like, for instance, the whole "We'll All Be Magic Superman," right?
Right.
I was thinking about that the other day. And, you know, of course, that's recorded backwards. So you have to listen to it backwards.
Right.
To hear him saying forwards, "We'll All Be Magic Superman." Well,
right.
To me, kind of a light went off. And I'm thinking about this in terms of the whole concept of the Saint community and the magical realism about it, right? You know, and I'm not just talking about the Saint community in the very specific sense of like the hardcore researchers who look at stuff, but I'm talking about all, you can feel everybody talking about this magical synchronicity, right? And being electrified by this. It's being even carried forward in the mainstream media in a way that's very alive, I think, quite frankly. Much more so than in the past that I remember, at least, is that there's an electricity to how close this idea that we are magical creatures really is. And what I was thinking about this in terms of the "We'll All Be Magic Superman" thing is that if time is actually reversing, perhaps what this is it's an illusion, right? We don't have any powers of observation or creativity or at all. We're just watching it backwards, and this is how come we know and we can understand these things, because it all starts to make sense in terms of the world actually going back in time. Do you follow what I'm trying to get at there?
Sure, sure.
So I know it sounds a little weird, but I mean, can you see how? You know what? It's like when you were a kid, or when I was a kid. You know, if you in the they showed you a movie in class, it was usually on 16mm when I was growing up, and if a teacher was really cool, they would sometimes play the movie backwards for you, right? So you know, you'd see things like water leaping backwards up waterfalls, right? And if indeed human beings were moving in a reality that had somehow been endowed with this underground backwards time stream, we could begin to think of ourselves as being creative in a way in which we're actually not. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, that was a buzz killer.
No. I process what you're saying. It usually takes me a second to, you know.
Yeah, like this is what I'm getting at, is that let's say time is going backwards, but for us, the sensation hasn't changed. So this could give us an idea, a sensation that we have abilities that we don't actually have. that instead the things are unfolding. And what I'm differentiating between here is the idea of what we are able to do as beings, what we think we want to do or what we think we're doing, and then finally, what we actually are underneath all of that, right? Like, I just, because to me, that final one, the thing that we are, becomes a really important principle in regards to studying these phenomena and the way in which they loop in and out of each themselves, is that they can become, to me, like, and I hate to, you know, I'm not a religious guy, but it's almost like it's a kind of a dangerous or a tricky church. I guess they call it chapel perilous sometimes, right?
Right.
You know, it's this place where, and it's very much, this is also what I posited about Eyes Wide Shut, is that the scene in Somerton is actually going backwards in time, not forwards. Everything, they're actually on the pinnacle. They're on the point where time changes from going forwards to backwards. That's what's taking place at Somerton, is it's a moment that allows the energies created there, allow time to be directed away from its supposedly linear reality, in which then after the end of the linear cycle, we would presumably either evolve, you know, become something else. Do you see what I'm getting? But there are these supposedly secret societies, and they have this technique where they can actually just, by the concentration of certain types of energy, and obviously sexual energy in terms of the six and rotating around the pillar and stuff like that, or around the, you know, the vav, the pin, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a pillar of a kind. So that's, it's all there in terms of the technology. To me, whenever I think about it, I can just see it as a mechanism. But the thing that doesn't change with the use of this mechanism is the philosophical position or the viewpoint of the person inside the system, right? Like, what are they thinking? What matters to them? Not so much about what's, and is there a difference, right? This is one of the big arguments in Sync. Ultimately, this is why I ended up getting kicked off the Sinkhole, for instance, back in the day, is because I am struggling with this idea of the difference between what it is we think we want and then the world in which we live in. What's the difference? And is there an actual path that is within the self that is more, perhaps either safer or more truthful or more positive than this one of Chapel Perilous, where we look into it and we see these amazing things that almost seem to be generated out of our own consciousness? I mean, I'm sure you guys have experienced that, right?
I don't understand why
it's like, wow, can this really be happening? It's almost like the universe responding to you.
Why would that get you kicked off the Sinkhole? I don't get it.
Well, they just didn't like my viewpoints, basically. You know, they thought that I was too hard-edged about this kind of stuff. They wanted, like, they you know, well, look, the fact of the matter is, if anybody cares, all my Sinkhole articles are still up there. And I don't know if they've taken down any of the comments, but there was one person at the Sinkhole who really didn't like me, and that person is the founder of the organization itself. So, and he just kind of didn't like what I was saying. He didn't find it positive enough, because I'm asking these questions. Is it possible that this is, you know, a very misleading or a potentially dangerous? I'm, you know, I've been called a Cassandra or a, you know, I love this stuff, right?
Okay, actually, now that you mention it, I'm surprised that they let you on there in the first place.
Oh, me too. I don't know why they let me on. I don't know why they let me on. And I wrote some articles that were, like, super hot there, and everybody was commenting on them like crazy, and there was some behind-the-scenes stuff going on. I got booted off, and then the very charming Will Morgan asked me, he said, you know, if you just apologize, we'll let you come back.
Right.
And I said, no, thank you.
Right.
But
it's probably for the best.
Oh, yeah, I like Will, too. He's a great guy. And he treated
me like, I said I like you, Mark.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I appreciate that, Joe. But yeah, no, they just, and I understand. I actually felt like they did the right thing, you know, because the synchro mysticism, that school, it's a school of mysticism. It's a religion, basically. And when you're going to a church, you have to follow the rules. And I was breaking the church rules.
Right. I didn't do what so when it came time to choose how to describe synchromysticism for the videos that I put up.
Yes.
I was debating on whether or not to take. So who was supposed to have coined the phrase. We actually, this is beside the point, but when I was young, we used the term synchromysticism it makes sense. Synchronistic, synchromistic. It's just a wordplay thing.
Yeah.
When I was young, we used that as a reference to what we were doing with film and albums.
There's nothing new under the sun. It's not right.
But
I was very cool.
I was debating on whether or not to take Jay Coates's definition, which is referring to finding meaning in the mundane, or to use the one that gets thrown around, which I resonate with more. I'm not against his definition. I just see it as a different angle on the thing. But basically,
well, no. I would never criticize Jay Coxey's work. I mean, right, the guy's he's a young genius. He's brilliant.
Absolutely.
His powers of observation and his artisanal skills are
right, but
quite impressive. And I've learned. I've enjoyed his work.
Sure.
But I'm not really talking about that so much as I'm just talking about the attitude behind it. Is
right. So I
call it the Oprah Winfrey effect. Right. You know.
Right. So I chose the definition that's looking for connections in what could be coming from secret societies, secret
organizations. Yes, I remember reading your definition, and I liked it a lot.
Or could be coming from the collective unconscious. And so, I prefer that could be more than this is what it is.
This is an interesting discussion because it becomes about terminology, and I like discussions about terminology because if we're believing in the actual value, and value differing from quality in the sense that if terms have an actual effect, if they can be used in a way to produce an effect, and it appears given the NLP that's all over the place these days that it can be, or that at least some people believe it can be, that obviously, therefore, the definition of these terms, since we're talking about a really volatile chemistry here, becomes really important, right? Definition becomes, like, the way in which terms, and I become a real bore when I start to talk, because I'm stopping, okay, what exactly do you mean by that word, you know? What does mystical mean to you, right? Because that word has different meanings. And in the case of, it's just my personal way of doing things to just say, you know what? I'm going to strip everything that might be Spread the Sunshine, Age of Aquarius, out of what I do, even when I feel it, because I do feel it, right? I mean, I get that incredible, the quickening feeling when you're faced with an extraordinary synchronous event. And so I have that feeling, but I resist it. I really resist giving into it because I want to yield something that's just my technique. And that's why it didn't work out there for me. And I do believe, and I will hold that, the synchromystic school, as it is experienced as an aggregate, is something of a religious experience.
Right.
It's something let's all talk about these extraordinary possibilities in life.
Right. Well, that's
that now
in the
exist
definition
that we just didn't have a way to see before. And I think that maybe it's just because time has been turned on its head. Right?
So if you look at the definition of mysticism, then.
I can't make you out right now, David.
If you look at the definition of mysticism, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
You have immediate consciousness of the transcendent or ultimate reality of God. The experience of such communion as described by mystics. Or three, a belief in the existence of realities beyond perceptual or intellectual apprehension that are central to being and directly accessible by subjective experience. Or four, vague, groundless speculation. So number three is, I think, what I would lean towards in this context. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm more of a four.
But if
I'm
you
more
say,
of a four on that one.
If you say intellectual apprehension, that's a little bit different.
What I really think, I mean, mysticism, like, it becomes something. See, that's what I mean when I say the definition of words. I wasn't trying to say, like, we need to run, although I do appreciate your nimble fingers in this matter. But the idea of a definition is what the word means to people, not what it actually supposedly means technically. And it also has, see, to me, this is a way of resolving all paradoxes. And this is what I do, is I look at the smallest possible detail of any given question, and then I also look at the most egregiously blown up version. So in the smallest possible detail, a word or a term is just something that's used to convey a little bit of information. And in the biggest and the most explosive principle, it could be a trigger that has the ability to affect the consciousness of others or even the shape of reality itself, conceivably. So you have those two things, one on the other side. One, just something very common like past assault. Yeah, I mean, does that mean anything, past assault? Is it just past assault? Does it have any kind of, like, is it, for instance, possible that we access terms, our mind accesses a term and terminology in general as a part of a system that allows us to believe we are in motion when we're not, right?
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So this would give you kind of like a Wachowski matrix sort of feel. Like maybe terminology actually has these powers both to either animate or to lock us in place rather than, you know, necessarily giving the emotion.
Right. If I want to understand the meaning of a word, I'm much more interested in the etymology of it than I am the definition.
Absolutely. Etymology is incredibly important, but also just things like just the plain sound that it makes. Forget about, because etymology ultimately becomes academic. Like they're trying to find the earliest versions of a word, the origins of every phrase in terms of what is available historically. But the act of listening to language, like, you'll never hear an etymologist talk about NLP. As a matter of fact, they'll laugh in your face, oh, that's bullshit, you know? And then you say to them, hey, how do you feel about New Directions? And then the next moment you're screwing them, right? You know, and they have no idea that you've just...
Well, it depends on who you're talking to.
Well, I know, but what I mean is that the idea of NLP is very, very subtle. It's exceptionally subtle.
Oh, yeah.
And this, it becomes a witch's brew of a sort. The language and the terminology upon which we draw, we reach out, it's almost for terms as if into some kind of, you know, a void. We have an idea what we want to reach for, but that's not necessarily what we bring in, right? This is almost a kind of Cthulhu type of thing, too, because, or however you say that term, because, you know, that idea of the fact that we can inadvertently channel certain types of elements is important to me. And so, therefore, terms and such like that become very, very important. And like for me, synchromysticism, everything is wrong about that term. First of all, because it says synchro, and it's not synchro, it's syncra, right? It's the opposite of crow, it's cra. That's how you say chronology, chronos. Or chronos is actually how the Greeks would say that term, chronos. You know, that round O isn't something that they use. It changes its meaning.
But isn't that
it changes
just,
the shape in terms of how it affects, at least I believe.
Are you saying that etymologically synchro is from the crow part of synchro is actually from chronos, same root?
Oh, absolutely. It is the same root.
Oh, really? I never heard that.
Yeah, it's exactly. Well, look it up.
Is it because of time?
Synchro, all that means is it means to happen at the same time.
Oh, because of time.
The
time,
word coincidence
time
actually means the same thing as synchronicity, by the way.
Right. Okay.
Right? Two things happening at the same time are both a coincidence and they are synchronous.
Right, but the way that the
same thing.
But when the term was coined, I mean, he's literally just saying attaching meaning to corresponding events or to corresponding anything. But then that's vague, and it's good that it's vague.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I like the vagueness of it. I'm intensely fond of both vagueness and pinpoint definitions, but with things as crazy as synchronicism,
I like to consume vagueness and produce pinpoint definitions. That's my MO.
Unfortunately, like the majority of my interactions with synchronicism are with people who aren't familiar with it, and they always want the answer, like, what is this? What the fuck are we dealing with? So for the social purposes of synchronicism, I always employ my favorite definition of it, which is it's whatever the fuck you want it to be. Like, I feel like with synchronicism, the more I try to pin it down, the more it becomes slippery to people who aren't familiar with it.
That's a very new age idea, right, Joe?
I think it is too, but I think that the definition of it being whatever you want it to be, it to me is very much in line with our relationship to the abyss or to everything that is, which is ultimately anything is whatever the fuck you want it to be, which I know sounds very not functional.
That is a potential. I think it's a strong and important potential what you're expressing, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The potential that things can be what we make them is very important to our reality. It's, you might say it's key, but that does not necessarily mean it's a key to a door we want to open, right?
No, I agree. But I think that it's especially potent.
One or the other.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I think it's especially potent when we're talking about synchromysticism because as sync heads, what we're doing is looking at all this you know, garbage that might be something, it might be nothing, and we're kind of drawing out of the abyss basically whatever the fuck we want to. So to me, it's just kind of funny to define synchromysticism as, well, it's whatever you really want it to be. And it's like, well, to what end? Like, what information are we extrapolating?
We're just making shit up.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're doing.
What I find out is what a person is really about. And maybe these things, media, you know, that's exactly what the term media means. It's something that you put in between two other things, right?
Right.
Something in the middle. It's become type of interface, right? So,
yes.
And it's also a recognition of the malleability of our interpretation, and that the thing in itself is we're always approaching the thing in itself, but then drawing our own ideas around that thing. And there's definitely some consensus realities being projected, and what makes those more?
I wonder about that.
And what makes
I struggle with these ideas?
What makes those more real?
Exactly
than anyone
I have researched this in terms of. You know, very things that you yourself, David, really key into, particularly the Beatles' Enigma, not so much the music until recently, and then Crowley. I've got my personal reasons for looking into those things. I neither celebrate and love nor hate those people. I just want to find out what, if anything, they're talking about. And one of the things that comes up over and over again, and it's connected between the two of them, obviously, between the Beatles and Crowley in so many ways that are subtle that we don't have time to talk about it right now, but the one thing that is repeated is this idea of turning the record player backwards.
Right, William S. Burroughs. Now,
go ahead.
William S. Burroughs was the one who showed. I think it was Paul. I'd have to talk to Patrick to be sure, but there is actually an interview with one of them where they talk about where they got the idea to play their music backwards. And it was in a basement with William S. Burroughs. He showed one of them how to do that. So that's the point at which
I'm a little bit skeptical, but
interestingly enough,
etymological researchers, they call that a ben trovato. It's Italian for a good story.
If the story is really good, there's
a chance it might be a little bit more subtle than that.
This is what they said.
But the idea of Burroughs, who is a beetle and who identifies with bugs, fits in perfectly with this in terms of the synchronistic value of it.
Where he got the idea in the first place is from book four. So, and it's not only that, but it's actually what Crowley recommends saying backwards to practice backwards is can you hear me now?
I can, but I missed that last 5 or 6 seconds.
Okay, well, basically what they say in Magical Mystery Tour, when he says, I am he, you are me, and we are all together, that is what is recommended. The specific thing that Crowley recommends
he talks about twisting it around. Yeah, I know. Believe me, I'm aware of that. I have researched this too. The two things I've researched the most actually are the Beatles' Enigma and then the 2001.
So you're aware then that William S. Burroughs was actually a Thelemite, admittedly so. And you can hear in a speech that he gives about dreams, about your relationship to dreams, he starts talking about Crowley and the idea of the Christian dying god and this and that. Mm-hmm. It's very overt. So you can see the Crowley influence on Burroughs, and then you can see his influence on the Beatles, specifically into playing music backwards.
The whole idea of this playing it backwards being something that would give a perception that might not actually be accurate is what I'm really trying to get at here. Because this idea of turning time around on itself is always examined in a strictly linear sense, like we're walking around a corner. But what if our position, what if our orientation doesn't actually change? What if we just turn a corner, but now we're literally walking through life backwards, essentially. And this is something that I like to examine. And I think it's a valid point. And I actually have to go right now, guys. I've really enjoyed this talk. But David, your last points about William Burroughs really kind of bring this through to me. And I'll explain why very quickly. So you have this idea of Beatles, right? And then you have the idea from Burroughs of himself, representing himself, or a typewriter in particular, as a type of a scuttling beetle. But he himself, feels transformed into these creatures as well. They're not just things that he observes, but things that he feels. And of course, his name even implies that, right? He's burrowing, right? Like a beetle does.
Right.
So, or some beetles, anyhow. So here's the thing. I don't know if you guys watched the TV show Hannibal. I would not necessarily recommend it, but for a lot of different reasons. But here's the key to all this that links all of this stuff together. And that it may be something that's a very dark turn. Let's just put it that way. Hannibal uses a technique, the filmmakers, because the show is actually about a character who is a like a serial killer, an FBI profiler, right? The good guy in the show. And he can go into the crime scenes, and he can actually go back in time in his mind and see everything that happened, right? As he was the first person killer, okay? So he can't see the person, but he can see the space as if he's gone back in time and entered the space of the killer. Well, what they do is they actually use the sound of clicking beetles every time he goes into this state on the soundtrack. It's on Netflix right now, both seasons, and the very first scene has a scene somewhat similar to this. And there's not only you will not only hear these clicking beetles representing him going back in time, but you will also hear a character make a reference to beetles or some form of bugs that seems to be a throwaway, right? It's just like one of those kind of, you know, comments that is not necessarily related directly to the story. So I just thought it was interesting in terms of going back in time, Crowley, the beetle, the scarab, all that other stuff, representing some kind of, like, and I'm beginning to think it's some kind of surface that we pass over, might be the wings of the beetle that can vibrate to create different, you know, I'm just guessing here about that last stuff, but I'm saying that this whole idea of going back in time might be what is giving or presenting what appears to be synchronicity when in fact it's kind of the opposite, which is to say things being unraveled. So, you know, you can smoke on your pipe and put that in.
Right. So I've been really fascinated with the fact that the first episode of the first season of Doctor Who came out on November 22nd, 1963. And how, you know, if you look at Stephen, I know that there was a film with John Malkovich at one point. I don't remember what it was called, where I think there's a time traveling element, if I recall correctly, with the murder of John F. Kennedy.
It's this episode of The Twilight Zone that I've had, that Joe is going to take a look at.
Right, so
involves time travel and JFK. There's something there.
There's a ton of stuff around that.
You know what? I really do have to go, guys. But okay. What I'm going to leave you with is my vision for a future religion. Okay, everyone will go to Dealey Plaza to get their picture taken in the exact spot where JFK was assassinated, and they'll have a little card they hold next to them that says "Mind equals blown."
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And then at the moment that the picture is snapped, they will actually experience a real-time version of JFK being assassinated from his perspective. And Osiris will, or Horus, whatever, will enter their body and wreak havoc on the world.
I like your idea that that the way what his death actually was that he was never shot. It was literally that the moment at which he realized he had a profound revelation about the nature of reality or whatever,
Mind is blown. Yeah, he's like, oh, wait a second. Where are my guards? And why is there no roof on this car? Oh, I get it. Boom. And it's over.
Yeah.
And that's actually a story by Jorge Luis Borges. He writes a story about this guy who goes to report on this event. And in a very David Lynchian or Kubrickian sort of way, he ends up becoming the center focus of the event and gets himself Wicker Man'd, basically, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's the same thing. It's like, oh, I see. This is all for me.
Right. All right,
gentlemen,
man.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, totally.
Hey, Mark, this is awesome. Good talking with you, man.
Yeah, all right. Absolutely.
Talk to you guys too. Take it easy.
Peace.
Bye bye.
Looks like it's just me and you, David.
And then there were two. I'm excited about your next video. I'm waiting for it eagerly to be all finished.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. I've only got like a minute or so here, but
that's fine. Yeah,
dude, this Super Tramps thing I've been staring at since you put it up. It's really mind blowing.
Yeah, it really is. And then if you look at the implications with Crime of the Century, all the way through it, it's too much. It's like when the song Crime of the Century plays in the film is actually when he steps into the office of the warden of the prison. It's pretty ridiculous. Be sure to look at the lyrics when you watch it too, because it's sometimes kind of hard to make out some of the things that are said, and it's totally profound.
Wait, you posted this somewhere?
Oh no, I haven't. I don't have a computer to do that yet. My friend's working on it, but pretty soon. But yeah, you can do it yourself. It's not that difficult. Highly recommended. Cool. But then
I'll have to get the details on how to do it from you, because this. I mean, I'm just blown away by this. Even the back, everything about it.
Yeah. Well, there's that, and then there's Crime of the Century, which is the monolith floating in space as a prison. And so that in and of itself, in relationship to the particular scene and what's happening, you have the monolith Hilton and Kubrick's connection to that. It's pretty profound. Absolutely.
Cool, man. All right. Well, I think I'm going to roll.
Yeah, that's fine. let's hang.
Interesting talk.
I saw that you texted me. I was away at the shindig. So
yeah, I figured you were out doing something. Yeah, no big deal.
Soon we'll hang out.
I don't know if you saw this already, but it just came to me that the U on Super, it's just interesting to me how the U is like split into two eyes by the tower. I'm just trying to make sense of it. So
split into two eyes. Let me see what you're talking about really quickly.
So it's the letter U, you know. It's there's got to be some kind of significance here. It becomes two eyes because the bottom is obscured by the top of the tower. It's also cool that those two eyes turn the tower into a tuning fork.
Yes.
Or like a beam of light emanating into space.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Two eyes. Oh, I got you. I see what you're saying. You got two eyes. Two eyes. Okay,
somehow interacts, like it's like a U interacts with the two towers and becomes two eyes.
Right. Well, this is the thing, is that Alex's eyes are held open, right? There's a song that finishes that album that's called Child of Vision. If you look at the cover, the poster that was commissioned by Kubrick for Clockwork Orange, you have a pyramid with an eye at the top, which is his hand coming out with the dagger, which is the top of his cane, which is what he uses to hit four times in front of the 2001 soundtrack. And so he's literally got, like, there's just this really weird connection of child of vision and what's being communicated, because that is literally, like, what he is, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and basically being forced to see something is the idea. It's like, and then you can see the metaphor is very direct, because it's like people aren't willing to look at something until it's the nature of inertia. It's like things are moving in a straight line in terms of consumerism, capitalism, and it's not until something comes along that's outside of it that forces it to recognize. You know, it's like in the nature of inertia, in order for it's something that's moving in a straight line that won't deviate its course unless there's something outside of it is acting upon it. And so this is an example of that. It's like 9/11 is like that. It's like we're doing our thing, and until something traumatic enough happens, we don't question what we're doing.
Right, and that's the theme of the song Child of Vision?
Yeah, basically. Child of Vision, won't you listen, you know? It's pretty heavy, absolutely. And the fact that it's gone Hollywood right when he's watching the fucking footage, you know, is really too much. You'll see.
Cool, man.
All right,
brother, good stuff.
Yeah, man. Well, take it easy. I hope to talk to you soon. Thanks for coming on in such short notice. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, man. All right, have a good day, dude.
All right, bye. I used to think that it would feel so good.
nothing to. I'm familiar as it slam the door.